good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go right.
You're listening to episode 621 of Unwelcome Guests, U.S. Capitalism from Start to Finish. I'm Robin Upton. And the subtitle, 9/11 as Endgame of the Capitalist Fundamentalists, should give you a clue that I've tried to pack quite a lot into this week's show. I've not forgotten the 11th anniversary of September the 11th. In our second hour, I'm going to be reading from a complex article that points the finger at financial crimes as a key motive for the events of September the 11th. Now that's a new angle. We haven't yet heard much about this on the show. That'll be in our second hour. The overarching theme of the show is to question that opinion so beloved of the commercially controlled media that there is something somehow natural and free about capitalism, that it has somehow always been with us, and by implication, therefore always will. We're going to start with a solid rebuttal of that from Charles Post, author of The American Road to Capitalism. He's going to be presenting the case that as long as people were allowed to live without getting themselves into debt, this was what they preferred to do. And America was a land of mainly self-sufficient farmers. The key step that was needed to switch people over to being wage laborers was it had to be made expensive to own land, because once you've got to borrow to do farming, you're under control of whoever sets the interest rate. If you've got to rent your land, you're under control of whoever is the landlord. And thank you to Sasha Lilly for this interview from Against the Grain Radio. You can see more of their material at againstthegrain.org. And this interview is from earlier this year.
While it may appear inevitable now, how did capitalism actually come to take hold in the United States, a country built on genocide, land expropriation, and slavery? Was slave production in the American South actually capitalist or something else? What was the nature of the Civil War and radical Reconstruction following it? These are questions that have been hotly debated for many years on the left, with significant consequences for how we see racial oppression today. Charles Post has made a number of probing interventions into these debates over the course of three decades, and Haymarket Books has now collected those pieces into the book The American Road to Capitalism, Studies in Class Structure, Economic Development, and Political Conflict, 1620 to 1877. Charles Post teaches sociology at Borough of Manhattan Community College, CUNY, and is a member of the organization Solidarity. He joins me now by phone from New York. Charles, welcome to the program. In thinking about the origins of American capitalism, what actually is at stake? Is this simply a scholarly question?
I would say it's not only a sort of scholarly and historical question, but it is, for me, these issues are very much political questions. And I want to sort of start from what I think are the sort of the first cut, broad political implication of my work and the work of the people who've influenced me the most, in particular Robert Brenner and Ellen Makeskins Woods, which is that the whole goal of the research that Brenner has done, I hope that the contribution I've made and others have, is to make the origins of capitalism problematic. It's basically to break with notions that capitalism has somehow always existed, or at least has existed for the last 8 to 10,000 years, and that the development and emergence of capitalism in any particular society is the result of trans-historical forces, whether those be the spread of markets, whether they be the development of the productivity of labor through the introduction of labor-saving tools and machinery. Instead, the argument is that the emergence of capitalism historically, first in England and then in a number of other societies, is the result of historically contingent, in particular, the unpredictable and contingent outcome of class conflict.
So in other words, you're saying that capitalism is not inevitable, is not a foregone conclusion, nor has it sort of been with us always and now relatively recently took on a full-blown form. Is that right?
Exactly. That, by rejecting that, what you're saying is this form of society has a history. And if it has a history, if its origins are historically contingent and not inevitable, then we can imagine the possibility, not the inevitability, but the possibility of a society beyond capitalism. If, in fact, we believe that it's always been there for the last, you know, throughout human history or the last 8 to 10,000 years, and it's only come to full fruition now, then the idea that there's something beyond it becomes impossible. Brenner had pointed out that in the 80s and 90s, the resurgence of what he calls the commercialization model in terms of the explanation of the origins of capitalism, the idea that capitalism was simply the result of millennia-long expansion of markets, corresponds very much to the dominance of neoliberalism, the idea that the, quote, free market economy is not only the best of all possible worlds, it's the only possible world. It corresponds very closely to a notion that there is no alternative. By making the origins of capitalism historically problematic, we pose the possibility of an alternative.
So then that necessarily leads to the question, how does one define capitalism?
In the book, I have a definition of capitalism, which basically, following Brenner, Wood, and following Marx, is essentially capitalism is the first form of society in which both non-producers, the exploiting class, and the direct producers are reproduced through the market, through the operation of what Marx called the law of value. You have a situation where capitalists must sell to survive. If they do not specialize output, introduce labor-saving machinery, accumulate land, capital, workers, etc., they will not be able to produce at or below socially average necessary labor time. Eventually, they will lose market share, and eventually, they will become extinct. They'll be driven to bankruptcy. At the same time, the direct producers, those who actually work, wage workers, etc., must compete in the marketplace in order to find employment, sell their labor power, survive. Thus, capitalism is thus the first society in human history in which both producers and non-producers must reproduce themselves through the marketplace. They are subject to market coercion. This is what gives capitalism its unique dynamics, in particular, larger, you know, units of production, centralization of capital, and most importantly, a continuous capitalization of production.
So you mentioned that for workers under capitalism, they're compelled to sell their labor within the market, that they do not have their own property that they can depend on to generate their livelihood. So it seems like this question of wage labor is central. Yet, is it possible to have a capitalist system where you have other social relations for workers that aren't based on wage labor? Is that a possibility?
Absolutely. Historically, in the development of capitalism and its origins in the transition to full-blown capitalism, you see a variety of forms. First of all, you see, and this is very important in the United States, but I think it's also important in all of these societies, that initially the emergence of capitalist agriculture is usually based on household production. Peasant producers who depended on the labor of themselves and their families and not on wage labor find themselves, the key to sort of the emergence of capitalism is the transformation of the conditions under which they get, keep, and expand land holdings so that they suddenly find themselves in a position where they must specialize output, innovate, etc. They must compete to survive. They must sell to survive. Now, at that point, you begin to see a process of social differentiation. Some of those household producers will do better, will be able to cut costs, make greater profits, accumulate more land. Some of their neighbors will lose their land, etc. Now, in agriculture, because of the specific natural biological character of agriculture, it's very difficult to stabilize wage labor because you only need wage labor at, you only need labor in agriculture at certain points in the year. But you begin to have a social differentiation. You also see historically capitalism involving legally coerced forms of wage labor, servitude, contract labor, etc. And capitalism, of course, historically has coexisted with, and more importantly, has created various non-capitalist forms which it attempts to incorporate to one degree or another. Plantation slavery in the New World, various forms of tenancy and peasant production in the Global South, etc. But it is the emergence of the relationship between capital and wage labor, and in particular, the subordination of all producers to the dictates of the market that's crucial to that transition.
So in terms of defining whether a system is fully capitalist, if it has these other components, some might be vestiges from the past, but others might be created that are coercive within the system, at what point does one define it as a fully blown capitalist system, if you follow me? Is it a quantitative question or a qualitative one?
I would say it's qualitative. Some people, including people in the tradition I work with, have attempted to make this a quantitative question by saying that until the majority of the population are wage workers, you don't have capitalism or the dominance of capitalism in the society. I don't particularly buy that. I think that once you see that a particular society, the dynamics are such that you have this competitive dynamic which forces all of the owners of means of production to specialize, innovate, etc., and they are capable of getting rid of less efficient producers, getting rid of excess labor, then you have basically a capitalist economy. Even if you have a situation where large portions of the population remain petty owners, owning family farms, for example. In my book, I argue that capitalism is dominant in the northern United States by the early 1840s. But it's really only in the 1860 census that the majority of the population in the North become wage laborers. But what you see is that by the early 1840s, even these family farmers who don't yet rely on wage labor are, in fact, subject to the dictates of the market. They must sell to survive. As a result, they specialize their output, they buy machinery, they become this growing home market for industrial capital, and they, in fact, help fuel the process of industrialization.
Well, so let's focus more on the United States. Now, we often hear that the U.S. is an exceptional nation, that its history is different than any other, its trajectory is different. And of course, your work focuses on the origins of capitalism in the United States. Can we say, just as a sort of starting point, are those origins in some ways exceptional?
Well, I would start from the position that the development of capitalism in every society in the world is in some sense specific and unique. The social relations that constitute capitalism, there are certain key relations that must exist for that form of society, that form of labor to exist. But the way in which it originates in every given society and the forms it takes in any given society is always historically specific. Marx understood this, the classical Marxist tradition before the First World War understood this, etc. So in some sense, the U.S. is as exceptional as Britain, as France, or any other capitalist society. Now, what are those unique characteristics? Well, it's not the claim that the classic liberals like Lewis Hartz and others made that capitalism came over on the first ships and that, you know, from the day one, it was a capitalist society. That was the goal of the merchants who organized the colonization of North America, but they found themselves in a situation where because they could not establish a market in land, they could not establish capitalist social relations in the colonial period. So you get the reproduction of essentially peasant production in the northern colonies, and in the southern colonies, you see the development of highly commercialized form of agriculture, completely enmeshed in an emerging world market, but which is based on non-capitalist relations, the master-slave relation. So in that sense, That's one of the things that make so that, yes, there's no feudal past, but there's clearly a pre-capitalist, a non-capitalist past in the United States, and that there was, in fact, a shift, a transition to capitalism in this society, in this country.
I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Charles Post, sociologist and the author of The American Road to Capitalism. So one of the features that it's striking, obviously, about the United States is the history of slavery. Now, there are some who have argued, including within the realm of Marxism, like Emanuel Wallerstein, that slavery in the United States was capitalist. You take issue with that. Tell us why you don't think that slavery should be understood, even though, as you say, it was highly commercialized, as a capitalist social relation in the American South.
Okay. I would argue that plantation slavery in the U.S., what becomes the U.S. South, and in the Caribbean, you know, both the first slavery of the 18th century, which was centered in Jamaica and Saint-Domingue, what becomes Haiti, and the second slavery that's centered in Cuba and Brazil, all of these forms are, in some sense, the product of the expansion and development of capitalism, particularly in England, and play an important role in promoting capitalist development in England in particular, in a given period of time. And that, in many ways, they have very strong similarities to capitalism. In particular, this is a form where, unlike the surface states that existed in Eastern Europe in the 15th and 16th century, where the lords could choose whether or not to produce for the market, and if prices got too low, they could retreat into basically making their estates, their manors, self-sufficient in food because they didn't have to pay for land. By contrast, the planters in what becomes the U.S. and in the New World generally are deeply in debt to buy land and slaves, and thus they must sell to survive. They are subject to competitive pressures in the world market. However, because of the relationship between master and slave, they respond to these market pressures, these competitive pressures, in a fundamentally different way. Now, for me, what makes that relationship not capitalist is not that the slaves are unfree workers. Many Marxists, people like Eugene Genovese, the Cuban scholar Manuel Moreno's Faginals, and others have argued that the fact that slaves are unfree means that they're not as motivated as free workers in capitalism, they can't develop their skills, and they're thus not as productive. I think this is false for two reasons. First, as I said, you can have unfree forms of wage labor where legal coercion is used to ensure that workers sell their labor power under the most horrendous and disadvantaged conditions. It also, this notion that slaves, because they're unfree, lack motivation, is really not Marxist. It's a liberal notion. You find it in Adam Smith. You find it in the work of John Cairns, the Anglo-Irish author who wrote The Slave Power in 1862. And it basically results in a form of idealizing capitalism. What makes slavery non-capitalist is that the slave owners do not purchase the slave's labor power. They do not purchase her or his ability to work for a fixed period of time, a day, a week, or a year. Instead, they purchase the laborer, as Du Bois put it, as means of production in human form. They buy the slave as they would a piece of machinery or a piece of land, which means that when there are possible opportunities or pressures to introduce labor-saving tools and methods, the planters cannot easily get rid of, expel labor from production. If the slaves had been wage workers at the end of the year, if the master had found a way to replace them with machines, they'd simply be fired. And as Marx would put it, they would be free, of course, to starve to death, as all workers who are unemployed under capitalism are. Instead, the master would have to sell the slaves to recoup their massive investment in the slave. So it is the fact that slaves appear as a constant rather than a variable element of production is what makes it non-capitalist. It results in several features of plantation slavery, and this is true not only in the U.S. South, but throughout the New World. There's distinctly non-capitalist. First and foremost, there is very little technical innovation. There is very little introduction of labor-saving tools, methods, and machinery. For the most part, the planters respond to market competition, but through geographic expansion, adding more slaves and more land. At the same time, you see an almost universal tendency towards trying to make the plantations self-sufficient in food, which actually the planters in the U.S. South actually succeed in doing by the middle of the 18th century. Slaves have to be maintained whether they work or not to maintain their value as fixed capital. Thus, what do you do with slaves during the slack season? In cotton cultivation, you need a lot of slaves to plant and even more to harvest, but you don't need that many in between. So what you see across the New World is masters putting slaves to work during the slack season, growing their own subsistence. So all of these facts, the fact that slaves, what the masters buy is the slave's person. They purchase the slaves as fixed capital is what gives plantation slavery its non-capitalist character. It's what forces the slave owner to respond to competitive market pressures in ways that are fundamentally different than a capitalist would. Capitalists would respond by introducing machinery, introducing labor-saving methods, getting rid of workers when they don't need them, etc.
So did slavery in the U.S. South, in fact, limit the growth of capitalism elsewhere in the United States?
Well, what I argue in the book is this, that as long as the transition to capitalism in the North, in particular, the subordination of Northern household producers, Northern family farmers, to the dictates of the market is not complete, and that process, I argue, begins around 1790 and is really completed in the late 1830s. Until that process isn't completed, then merchants buying and selling cotton for the world market, buying and selling land, public lands, etc., are the driving force of the U.S. economy. And in that period, before the late 1830s, the geographic expansion of slavery in the U.S. does promote capitalist development and promotes the conditions for capitalist industrialization. It does not do this by directly funneling profits from slavery, from the production of cotton, into industry. The only place that happens is in one or two large cotton mills in New England. Most of American manufacturing is not financed through big banks, the stock market, or comes through the activity of wealthy merchants investing in manufacturing. Instead, it comes out of the activities of well-off master artisans who transform themselves into capitalists. Instead, the way that slavery promotes capitalism is that the expansion of slavery, the export of cotton, allows the U.S. to have a favorable balance of trade, allows merchants in the North to borrow money in Europe, which they then use to fuel land speculation. And what I argue in the book is that the process of land speculation, the buying and selling of public lands from about 1805 to the late 1830s, is what completes the process of subordinating Northern family farmers to the dictates of the market. It's at that point, in the late 1830s, early 1840s, once agriculture in the North has been thoroughly transformed on a commercial capitalist basis, then it's the interactions of these petty capitalist farmers and capitalist manufacturers that drives the development of capitalism. And it's at that point onward that the further geographic expansion of slavery becomes an obstacle to capitalist development. Because in the regions where slavery is dominant, petty capitalist agriculture cannot develop, and capitalist industry remains underdeveloped.
Well, let's stay for a moment with these family farmers who you've mentioned. Now, the family farm has a sort of hallowed place in the American imagination, including in parts of the left. And some scholars on the left, you mentioned Jim O'Connor, in one of the essays in your book, The American Road to Capitalism, considered the family farm as potentially its own mode of production, that it followed its own logic, and basically posed the question that there might have been the possibility before the Civil War for family farming to become an alternative to wage labor of people just producing for the market who have no property. What do you make of that argument?
That was true until the 1790s. Okay? That notion that these family farms were based on the ability of any free person, which means free white person, and that which is one of the things that defines being white in this period. Any free white person could essentially go out into the frontier areas, form militias with other free white people, kill off some Native Americans, grab their land, and squat on it, and essentially appropriate that land outside the market. Thus, it was an alternative to wage labor in the colonial period and up until, I'd say, the 1790s. That's absolutely true. There could have been an alternative to capitalism, not one that was that I think anybody on the Marxist left today should see as terribly progressive, but it was a possible alternative based on sort of peasant, free peasant property, etc. However, the conditions under which people obtain, keep, and expand land holdings changes radically after the constitutional settlement. In the book, I argue that the turning point for northern agriculture and the northern family farm is the revolution and the constitutional settlement. The revolution disrupts the dynamics of self-sufficient, safety-first household production in the north, creates and sets the stage for massive social conflicts in the post-revolutionary period between these basically peasant producers, these free peasants in the north, and local governments that are trying to collect taxes, bankers who are trying to collect debts, and most importantly, on the frontier, with confrontations with land companies, land speculators, who claim legal title to the land and want the people who are basically squatting on the land either expelled or forced to pay a market price for this land. I argue in the book that one of the key things about the constitutional settlement is that it creates a sufficiently centralized state that can actually create a standing army and integrate what used to be citizen militias at the state level, militias that were dominated by subsistence farmers and urban artisans. It is able to integrate these militias, quote, professionalize them, make them part of the regular army, and are thus have an instrument by which, in the 1790s, to basically smash the resistance of these northern farmers. And I'd argue by 1800, the resistance of these northern farmers to the commodification of land, to the imposition of a land market, is essentially broken. This allows then the federal government in the early 1800s to set up the public land system, where they are selling land. While there's minimum prices, there's no maximum prices. Land is sold at public auction. And by the 1830s, 90 to 95% of actual settlers are not buying land directly from the federal government. They're not squatting on it. They're buying it from big land companies, which means that in order to get land, you have to have accumulated some capital, go into very deep debt, and in order to pay off that debt, you must specialize output, innovate, etc. So the idea that as late as the 1840s or 1850s, the West, the Northwest, is some sort of alternative to wage labor, where people can escape wage labor, as Frederick Jackson Turner argued in the late 19th century, and unfortunately, Jim O'Connor in that article from the 70s reproduces, is a complete myth. By the 1840s, no urban wage worker, even the most skilled, steadily employed wage worker, could afford to buy and set up a commercially viable farm.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by Charles Post, the author of The American Road to Capitalism, Studies in Class Structure, Economic Development and Political Conflict, 1620 to 1877. That's published by Haymarket Books, and we have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He's professor of sociology at Borough of Manhattan Community College, CUNY, and a member of the socialist organization Solidarity. So you've already been touching on this to some degree, but I want to ask you directly, how did the industrial bourgeoisie develop in the United States?
Okay, for the most part, with the exception of some of the more important cotton textile factories in New England, for the most part, most industrial capitalists, whether you're talking about, and particularly in the, what I think are the most important branches of industry, iron production, the production of farm implements and farm machinery, the processing of foodstuffs, whether that be flour milling, meat packing, etc. Most of the industrial capitalist class in the United States emerges from the ranks of artisan producers, of small producers in the colonial period. This is an example of what Marx in the third volume of Capital called the truly revolutionary road to capitalist industry. You see these artisans being subjected to market competition, and we see then a process of social differentiation. A handful do well and accumulate means of production, etc., become full-fledged capitalists, while the vast majority are reduced to wage labor. There's an extensive historical literature in the United States now. People like Sean Wilens, people like Sven Beckard. There's a classic study by Livesay and Porter from the mid-70s, which show very clearly the vast majority of manufacturing capitalists, industrial capitalists in the United States, emerge from the ranks of the artisans, and through their own self-exploitation, the exploitation of their journeymen, and partnerships with small merchants who are often the first merchants who specialize in particular industrially produced goods, they accumulate and emerge as a class of capitalist manufacturers by the 1840s and 1850s. Now, as this process of class differentiation of the artisans is sped up as northern agriculture is subordinated to the logic of the market, to market coercion. Because as these farmers are forced to produce, sell to survive, they have to specialize output, which means that they're no longer buying, they're no longer producing for themselves cloth, shoes and boots, other consumer items. At the same time, competition is forcing them to look for and being willing to purchase the most advanced tools, machinery, etc. So they become a market for industrially produced capital goods. They become this home market. And what I argue is that at the center of capitalist industrialization in the United States, particularly in the 1840s and 50s, is what I called an agro-industrial complex, a series of industries producing inputs for the northern agriculturalists, plows, eventually the mechanical reaper, etc., and processing farm output. We start to see by the late 1850s steam-powered large-scale flour milling, and we also begin to see quite extensive meatpacking industries. There's a very good master's thesis and a couple of articles by Mary Beth Puttup, who teaches at UC Santa Cruz, on the sort of centrality of meatpacking, farm implements production, flour milling to the antebellum industrial revolution. Now, it's this, the fact that they emerge out of the ranks of the artisans is one of the things that promotes a certain actual petty bourgeois radicalism among the manufacturers in the U.S. because they see themselves, they experience the world as self-made men. They believe it is through their own efforts as free laborers that they have become capitalists. They believe that any of their workers, through similar efforts, along with some tariff protection and the containment of slavery, can become capitalists as well. So they embrace what is a fairly radical, basically petty producer ideology of free labor. which is the sort of the centerpiece of the ideology of the Republican Party in the late 1850s.
Sure. And the vestiges of that ideology certainly permeate our society in different ways today.
Absolutely.
Now, we're going to talk a lot about the crucial question of labor in the South. But before we get to that, I want to ask you about how was the working class in the North formed, and perhaps we should say, how was it made?
Okay. Well, the Northern working class is made through two processes. First, and then in sort of ascending order of importance, first through a process of social differentiation of farmers in the North and of artisans. So the first wage labor force in the New England factories, and this is true not only of cotton textiles, but of shoes and boots, etc., are the daughters of struggling New England farmers who can no longer accumulate enough land to marry off their daughters to other petty producers and send their daughters off to work in these factories so that their wages can be used to try to support basically failing family farms. You see similarly their social differentiation among the artisans. As the minority of artisans become basically capitalist manufacturers, the majority are reduced to permanent wage labor. They may still be, for the most part, highly skilled, but they are wage laborers. The other and dominant way in which the working class in the North is formed is through immigration. The U.S. is the beneficiary of processes of primitive accumulation in Europe, particularly in Ireland. The potato famine and the massive expropriation of the Irish peasantry leads to massive migration to the U.S. in the 1840s and 1850s, creating a large pool of labor, of essentially unskilled labor, for larger scale manufacturing and for basically labor-intensive gang labor, building canals, building railroads, working on the docks, etc. So the northern working class is made through those two processes. And those two processes then leave very sharp divisions within the northern working class in the 1840s and 50s. The more skilled workers, who generally come from background of either were a generation or so ago skilled artisans, self-employed, or were the children of skilled children of farmers, etc., these people tend to gravitate towards, on the one hand, profoundly nativist politics. They are attracted to the American Party, which basically campaigns on limiting the right of immigrants, particularly the Irish Catholics, to become citizens. And then later, at the same time, they're attracted to anti-slavery, free soil politics, and in particular the Republican Party. So most highly skilled, native-born Protestant workers vote Republican in the 1850s and 1860s. On the other hand, the Irish Catholic working class, for the most part unskilled, unable to stabilize any of its own basic organizations, unions, etc., and who face incredible forms of essentially racist domination, Ignatieff's book on how the Irish became white is very illustrative of the fact that the Irish were, prior to the Civil War, not considered white people. In response to that, they grasp onto a defensive form of whiteness through the Democratic Party in the North. The Democratic Party integrates elements of the immigrant middle classes into their ranks and basically creates in the North a substantial voting base among unskilled Irish Catholic workers for what is essentially this party of slavery and white supremacy, the Democrats.
All right, so I want to ask you the same question about the South to do with the making of labor there. But to get there, of course, we need to talk about the Civil War. So
right.
Let me just ask you, how should we understand the Civil War? It tends to be seen politically, sometimes socially. How would you have us understand it?
Well, I would characterize, and this is part of an ongoing debate that's developed among Marxists in the last 20 years about the notion of the bourgeois revolution. And it's a very long discussion. But what I would argue is that socially and politically, the Civil War is, in some sense, a bourgeois revolution. It consolidates the capitalist state and the rule of capital on a national level. It removes a major obstacle to the expansion of capitalism throughout the rest of the U.S. society by abolishing slavery. It allows the industrial capitalist class to put into effect, through the Republican Party, tariffs, government subsidies to railroads, etc. In other words, it's a revolution, it's a political conflict, a revolution that results in the dominance of capital and capitalism politically and economically. However, as a democratic revolution, as a revolution that would promote not just the right to vote and citizenship, which it does very unevenly, but as a revolution that substantially empowers labor in their capacity to transform their conditions of life. In particular, in the South, that would mean a radical land reform, 40 acres and a mule, which would have allowed former slaves to transform themselves in the U.S. South the way former slaves in the Caribbean did after emancipation, to become self-sufficient peasant producers. That doesn't happen. So the U.S. Civil War and Reconstruction is a very good example of the fact that the idea that most successful bourgeois or capitalist revolutions are, in fact, highly undemocratic, and that the sort of notion of a bourgeois democratic revolution, a revolution that promotes both capitalism and substantive democracy, an idea that was invented by Russian social democrats in the late 1890s and early 1900s, that idea is actually an oxymoron. It's a contradiction in terms, because to the extent that these revolutions succeed in promoting capitalism, they restrict substantive democracy. To the extent that they promote substantive democracy, they throw up obstacles to capitalism.
Right. So you actually write that legal coercion, rather than being something that is a holdover from the old, more authoritarian order, is actually always a necessary element to establish capitalist social relations. That
absolutely,
that these are not actually opposites, but go necessarily together.
Exactly. And particularly when you look at the U.S. South, you see this. I mean, even if you look at the North, legal coercion of the household producers, forcing these people to buy the land that they had occupied and cultivated, was a necessary precondition for capitalism to emerge in the North. In the South, it's very clear. Without legal coercion, the former slaveholders, the planters, could not guarantee that they would have sufficient workers to plant and, more importantly, to harvest cotton. And in fact, what we see is that the first attempts to establish capitalist agriculture in the immediate aftermath of emancipation, the end of the war in 1865-66, involved these incredibly draconian black codes, which restrict the freedom and mobility of black labor in the South, that these were part and parcel of an attempt to establish capitalist agriculture. When those laws are repealed by radical Reconstruction, when the former freed people not only gain citizenship and the vote, but actually are able to take hold of local offices like justices of the peace and county assessors, etc., they use that power to undermine the capitalist social relations and protect the sharecroppers. I mean, basically, sharecropping is a concession by the planters to the resistance of their former slaves.
Right,
they don't want to break up their plantation.
You place class struggle very centrally in your argument about the origins and development of capitalism in the United States. And you argue that after the Civil War, capitalism was not replaced by either capitalist plantation agriculture nor by the formation of a class of black farmers, like happened in the Caribbean, but instead you ended up with this non-capitalist form, which is sharecropping. And you detailed the kind of class struggle that led to this. And of course, people have to remember that there was tremendous class struggle that happened during the Civil War and afterwards by black free men and women. So how did that end up leading to sharecropping, which of course was in its own way very coercive?
Well, it becomes initially, it is not that coercive. Basically, the former slaves, the freed people, are in a very, very strong position once the black codes are repealed, once they have the vote, and once the Republicans take over most of the southern state governments. And while the former freed people are essentially excluded from the highest echelons of power in these state governments, they have power at the local level. They're the justices of the peace, and they're the county tax assessors. They are able to use those positions through the mid-1870s to basically get the best possible deal under sharecropping, to prevent the landlord class from getting heavy taxes placed on the tenants, to resist crop lien laws, which would basically say that the first claim of creditors is on the share of the crop that goes to the sharecropper, etc. And that much of the resistance of the white former slaveholders, the white landlord class in the 1870s, much of what, you know, powers the reestablishment of white supremacy, the so-called redemption movement, the use of terror, Klan terror, election fraud, etc., to overthrow Republican rule in the South, is the desire of the landlords to regain an upper hand with their tenant farmers, to impose heavier taxes on them directly, and to impose crop lien laws. And what we see in the aftermath of redemption, of the reestablishment of democratic white supremacist rule in the South in the late 1870s, is that not only does sharecropping in the old plantation districts, where most of the sharecroppers are African American, become more coercive, etc., but that this form spreads to the Pine Barrens in the upcountry, where you had formerly independent subsistence white farmers who by the late 1880s are themselves reduced to tenancy and debt peonage. And it's in the, by the late 1880s that you have, for the first time since Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, you have poor blacks and poor whites not only being poor, but being part of the same class. They're all tenant farmers. And this is then the basis for populism. And it's the defeat of populism, I argue, and the imposition of Jim Crow, disenfranchisement of African Americans and a significant portion of poor whites, the imposition of legal segregation of public facilities, and the unleashing of renewed racist terror, lynching, etc., that is crucial to the final establishment in the early 20th century of capitalist plantation agriculture in the South.
So did sharecropping create its own obstacles to capitalism?
Well, within the South, it creates its own obstacles to the development of capitalism. Now, on the one hand, the sharecropping system means that the slaves no longer are growing their own subsistence, making their own clothing, etc. They're being forced to grow more and more cotton. As a result, there's some growth of a market for consumer goods. At the same time, during the slack seasons, when the sharecroppers are not actively growing cotton during a period between planting and harvesting, they become available as temporary migratory workers in mining, timbering, etc. So while the South remains fairly underdeveloped through the late 19th century because of sharecropping, sharecropping provides more opportunities for capitalist investment in the North, particularly in natural resource extraction, coal mining, timbering, etc. And most importantly, sharecropping doesn't have the same geographic expansionist dynamic that slavery did. Thus, it doesn't pose an obstacle to the expansion of petty capitalist agriculture and capitalist industry in the rest of the U.S.
Well, I'm afraid we're really running out of time, but with that question of expansion or non-expansion in mind, I've asked you about the origins of capitalism in the North and the South. Let me ask you about the West and also about the position of Native Americans within this framework of looking at the development of capitalism from above and from below.
Well, what I would say, starting with Native Americans, is that the expropriation of Native Americans is a necessary precondition for the emergence of any commodity production and any white settler colonization in North America. The issue, though, in the colonial period was that simply expropriating the Native Americans through force and fraud was not sufficient to create capitalist social relations. Until you could not only expropriate the Native Americans, but force white settlers to buy land rather than appropriate it outside the marketplace, you don't have capitalism. But once you have that system of land sales, et cetera, in place, and particularly after the Civil War, so-called Indian Wars and Indian removal becomes even more rapid and vicious in the post-Civil War period, because now there are very powerful social forces other than northern farmers and southern planters who want the Native Americans expropriated, pushed into to the reservations, etc., so that they can expropriate their land for capitalist agriculture, for transportation infrastructure construction, etc.
Within the Marxist tradition, the whole question of the transformation of agriculture, the so-called agrarian question, the formation of capitalism, mattered not simply as a historical question, but also as one that would set in motion a form of capitalism. And the presumption was that form of capitalism would set the stage in some way that might be more or less amenable to the hastening of socialism ultimately. Given everything that you've talked about the origins of capitalism, I guess I want to ask you, at the beginning of the program, you talked about the stakes, and I want to sort of end on a political question, which is to ask, do you think that the development of capitalism in the United States has political implications for those of us who would like to go beyond it?
Well, I think it has, the analysis I present has implications for how we understand racism and racial domination in the U.S. In particular, I think my work challenges the notion that the racial oppression of African Americans and other people of color is somehow linked to the incompletion of something called the bourgeois democratic revolution, that racism is somehow linked to the continued reproduction of pre-capitalist or non-capitalist relations. My argument is instead, racism is very much rooted in and reproduced through capitalist social relations, through the dull compulsions of the marketplace. And my argument has some implications for understanding the process of post-Civil War formation of the U.S. working class, the importance of geographic mobility of capital and labor across the continent to the undermining of stable working class organizations in the 1870s and 1880s. In terms of the agrarian question, I would argue that it sheds some light on questions about agriculture in what we used to call the Third World and the Global South prior to the 1970s, and shed some light on the actual character of peasant struggles prior to the 1970s. Now, I'm one of those people who believes that, in fact, capitalism has, in fact, destroyed the peasantry in most of the Global South, that what we are seeing today is very much the development of firmly capitalist agriculture, either on the basis of contract farming, where small-scale farmers contract with big transnationals, or on the basis of plantation agriculture in some areas, etc. It's becoming more mechanized, and what you get is continued deepening rural poverty, but not based on the parcelization of land holdings as a result of pre-capitalist relations, but on the basis of the expulsion of labor from production on a very capitalist basis. Does that get at sort of the question you were asking?
It does indeed. And Charles Post, I want to thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, and thank you very much for inviting me.
I've been speaking with sociologist Charles Post. He's the author of The American Road to Capitalism, Studies in Class Structure, Economic Development, and Political Conflict, 1620 to 1877. That's published by Haymarket Books.
Fairly similar themes tackled by Charles Post there to those we heard two episodes ago in 619, looking at control of the land by the hierarchy. The settlers come, they're better armed, and they kick off the native Indians. No need to bother about justifications. Some token story about the white man's destiny. Job's a good'un. That allows people, and that allowed the white settlers to be largely independent of a capitalist system, not needing to sell their labor because they can survive on the farms of the stolen land. But when the land expansion comes to an end, when there's no more land available for ready theft, then capitalism can operate because there's a land scarcity. So the previous class of masters, the white settlers, subsequently have to pay. Now, we've looked at in the show before how subsistence farmers were forced to pay through manipulation of the market, and as John Taylor Gatto points out, forced schooling in the US sets in to the end of the 19th century when factory owners realize we are not going to get these adults to follow orders, but if we train their children young enough, then we can get their children to follow orders. They can be wage laborers in the factory. Of course, if you've been following our ongoing reading of David Graeber's Debt, the first 5,000 years, one of the main themes in that book is the fact that the dichotomy between the free market or government regulation is something of a fake. And in fact, governments and markets are highly dependent on each other, and the privileged position that the government claims through controlling the currency and the laws of how the market should operate uniquely positions it to use fledgling markets to support its own military, and with the military in place, to use that for economic ends. And we're now going to get back to David Graeber. I must say, I find this bit slightly stretching my credibility, that the Chinese are having a long policy of showering people with gifts and magnanimity. I think it might be more that they realize that they're heavily outgunned, at least for the moment, so they're following orders. Anyway, certainly interesting historical perspective. This is from the final chapter of Debt, the First 5,000 Years.
At this point, some US creditors clearly feel they're finally in a position to demand that their own political agendas be taken into account. Quote,
China warns US about debt monetization. Seemingly everywhere he went on a recent tour of China, Dallas Fed President Richard Fisher was asked to deliver a message to Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. Stop creating credit out of thin air to purchase U.S. treasuries. Unquote.
Again, it's never clear whether the money siphoned from Asia to support the U.S. war machine is better seen as loans or as tribute. Still, the sudden advent of China as a major holder of U.S. treasury bonds has clearly altered the dynamic. Some might question why, if these are really tribute payments, the United States' major rival would be buying treasury bonds to begin with, let alone agreeing to various tacit monetary arrangements to maintain the value of the dollar and hence the buying power of American consumers. But I think this is a perfect case in point of why taking a very long-term historical perspective can be so helpful. From a longer-term perspective, China's behavior isn't puzzling at all. In fact, it's quite true to form. The unique thing about the Chinese Empire is that it has, since the Han Dynasty at least, adopted a peculiar sort of tribute system whereby, in exchange for recognition of the Chinese Emperor as world sovereign, they have been willing to shower their client states with gifts far greater than they receive in return. Technique seems to have been developed almost as a kind of trick when dealing with the northern barbarians of the steppes who always threatened Chinese frontiers, a way to overwhelm them with such luxuries that they would become complacent, effeminate, and unwarlike. It was systematized in the tribute trade practiced with client states like Japan, Taiwan, Korea, and various states of Southeast Asia. And for a brief period from 1405 to 1433, it even extended to a world scale under the famous eunuch admiral Zheng He. He led a series of 7 expeditions across the Indian Ocean. His great treasure fleet, in dramatic contrast to the Spanish treasure fleets of a century later, carrying not only thousands of armed marines, but endless quantities of silks, porcelain, and other Chinese luxuries to present to those local rulers willing to recognize the authority of the emperor. All this was ostensibly rooted in an ideology of extraordinary chauvinism. What could these barbarians possibly have that we really need anyway? But, applied to China's neighbors, it proved extremely wise policy, for a wealthy empire surrounded by much smaller but potentially troublesome kingdoms. In fact, it was such wise policy that the US government, during the Cold War, more or less had to adopt it,